and welcome to Sticky from the Inside, the employee engagement podcast that looks at how to build stickier, competition-smashing, consistently successful organisations from the inside out. I'm your host, Andy Gorham, and I'm on a mission to help more businesses turn the lights on behind the eyes of their employees, light the fires within them, and create tons more success for everyone. This podcast is for all those who believe that's something worth going after and would like a little help and guidance in achieving that. Each episode, we dive into the topics that can help create what I call stickier businesses, the sort of businesses where people thrive and love to work, and where more customers stay with you and recommend you to others because they love what you do and why you do it. So, if you want to take the tricky out of being sticky, listen on. Okay, today we are embarking on what I think will be a truly fascinating journey, a journey into the world of values, ethics, and the profound impact that they have on the world of business. But we'll be doing it through a lens that we haven't used before on the podcast. Yes, my friends, today we're diving deep into the topic of axiology. Now, what's axiology? I hear you cry. Well, it's a string of philosophy that stems back to an ancient Greek philosophy that was further built on by the great German philosopher Robert Hartmann and is all about the structure of value. But fear not, you don't need to be a student of Greek philosophy or the works of Hartmann to get something out of today's episode. I have someone with me today who synthesized all that work and put it into practical, understandable, and useful language. And I get the feeling that axiology is about to become your new best friend in understanding how to create businesses that aren't just successful, but are genuinely good for the world and the people that work in them. But how do you build a business that genuinely adds value to the community it serves? How can leaders inspire their teams to unleash their creativity, fulfill their potential, and be run with generosity at its core? These are the kind of juicy questions, my friends, we're going to be tackling today. With the guidance of our remarkable guest, Dr. Randy Ross, who's been at the forefront of transforming workplace cultures and written some great books on the subject like Remarkable, Relationomics, and Fireproof Happiness. We'll explore the fascinating topic of axiology through the maxims of viability, creativity, and generosity. These aren't just lofty ideals. They are practical, actionable philosophies that can shape the way we think about business, leadership, and our impact on the world around us. So whether you're a CEO, a budding entrepreneur, or someone who just gets passionate about creating positive change, I think this is an episode for you. So get ready to be inspired, challenged, and maybe even transform the way you think about business of doing good. Welcome to the show, Dr. Randy.
Thank you, Andy. It is a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, I am very, very happy to have you here today, not least because we're going to tackle an old age problem from a very, very different perspective today. Your introduction to me to the world of axiology has proven very, very interesting and intriguing for me. So I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into that today with your help. Before I run headlong, excitedly, like a kid on a beach towards the sea of axiology, let's just take a breath. Do us a favor, Randy, will you? Can you give us a bit of a better background to what you've been up to than I've given you and what your focus is on today?
Absolutely. And thanks for asking the question. I am an author. I'm a speaker. I get the opportunity to travel around the globe and speak to various organizations about how they can craft better cultures. And I like to say it this way. Organizations thrive when they produce relationally rich environments where people enjoy not only what they do, but who they do it with, because we know that happy people do better work. That's not a secret. It's pretty intuitive, if you ask me. But the reality is there's so many organizations whose environments are not conducive to providing relationally rich experiences for their people. Either they're filled with toxic behavior or competitive leadership. There are a wide array of issues that can take root within organizational life that are not necessarily productive. Yep. And so I get the opportunity to go in and talk to organizations about how they can increase their employee engagement, which we know is just simply someone's emotional attachment to the work experience. And we do so often unpacking these principles from the field of axiology. So it's a lot of fun for me.
And we're doing this, I suspect, without even knowing it's coming from this philosophy of axiology, right? I mean, I'd never heard of it before we spoke briefly originally in our catch-up. And so I'm really interested to understand, why is this topic so important to you, Randy? And where did your connection to axiology start?
Okay, well let's start off with the basic premise that I think we can all agree upon, that people like to do good business with businesses that do good. Let's just start there. And the interesting thing about axiology is a strain of philosophy, as you mentioned earlier, but it's a science as well, trying to understand and define what is good and how do you measure it within organizational life. And so what we want to do is understand good and then help to create movements of good within organizational life. So an organization that does good for all of their stakeholders, meaning their employees, their team members, those that they have responsibility for caring for directly, then their customers or their clients, whom those that they care for are then responsible for caring for, and then also their shareholders. It's what we're trying to do is to create a movement of good that covers all of those bases for all of those stakeholders, not just the shareholders. And in so many organizations, particularly if they're public company, their first and foremost responsibility they feel is the fiduciary responsibility to their shareholder. But the challenge oftentimes comes in, if that's our sole focus, is just producing the best quarterly return that we can, then oftentimes we compromise long-term benefit to obtain short-term objectives.
Yeah.
And we compromise the entire organization or the endeavor if we're trying to build an organization that's going to have as much value and impact as it can over the course of time. So I think we have to make sure that we keep all of that in balance. And the principles of axiology are profound in helping us do that.
So for the uninitiated, why do you think it is such an interesting topic and so applicable for where we are today with business and this tension that you talk about between doing good by everybody and delivering a return that we need to today?
Well, it does go back to Plato, Socrates, way back, because they began to talk about what is valuable. What are the things that are necessary for human beings to thrive? So the conversation does go all the way back to the Greek philosophers. And you're also right in saying that the father of modern axiology, in many people's estimation, is Dr. Robert Hartman, whose story in itself is very, very fascinating because he was born in 1910 in Berlin, Germany. And he, by the age of 22, he had studied philosophy in Paris. He had studied economics in London. He had studied law theory in Berlin. And he came back to Berlin to actually teach at the University of Berlin while serving as an assistant district court judge. But he wrote his doctoral thesis on preserving human dignity in the legal system. A very worthy doctoral dissertation. The only problem was it's now 1932 in Berlin, Germany. And he's talking about preserving human dignity in the legal system while the Third Reich is coming to power, right? Yeah. And so he was targeted. He was Jewish. His name was Robert Sirkauer, but he adopted the name Robert Hartman, and he fled to England. Mm-hmm. And there he had a chance encounter with a guy by the name of Walt Disney. Interestingly enough, and he became Walt Disney's close friend and confidant. He became his personal advisor for about 8 years, actually, in the Disney organization. And now I share that for a reason. Think about this. Hitler, Disney. Because you think of any two antithetical characters in history, you know, because you've got this one individual from Hartman's standpoint who was creating this movement of evil in the world. And now you got Disney. And he thought, you know, if an individual can create a movement of evil, why cannot individuals create a movement of good? And that's what he infused into the early years of the whole Disney enterprise. And he was literally, if you want to call it, the first chief human resource officer for the Disney organization. He left there after 8 years and went back into the academic realm, where he continued to build out this structure of value theory.
Yeah.
But I think that all the principles that Axiology teaches is a perfect course, step by step, on how organizations can grow to create these thriving environments that are focused on human flourishing and doing good. Because as organizations create movements of good, then they indeed can have a profound impact, not only externally, but internally first. And organizations really understand the power of taking care of your own people. When you put your people above profits, profits will come. Here's a great question for your listening audience. And this is one that many people struggle with. What's the purpose of business? Now, if you ask anybody, especially in the West, in a master's program, they will tell you there'll be a long, flowery definition about providing a product or service that meets a need in the market to produce. You know, but it all comes down, if you boil it to its essence, it's about making money. And I wholeheartedly disagree.
Me too.
I think the purpose of business is to improve the human condition. I think the purpose of business is to do good in the world. And here's what I know to be true. I know that people will gladly pay full price for those things that they deem bring true value to life. And so the idea then is not, it's about making a difference in the world before you make a dollar. If you make a difference in the world, you will make a dollar or a pound or whatever or a euro or whatever. But the idea is solid in the sense that when we create value for people, they will be attracted in droves. And here's the thing. When we do it in such a way that we demonstrate care and compassion, then that's significant. I wrote a book several years ago called Remarkable. And remarkable means that you provide a service or a product and you do it in such a way that you blow people away. You exceed all expectations. You deliver second mile service. You go above and beyond. You mark people's lives for good to such a degree that when they leave your presence, they have this irrepressible desire to talk about you. And when they're talking about you, when they're remarking about you, then you indeed have become remarkable. And Axiology is an attempt to become remarkable. It's about leaving an indelible impression upon people's lives that's not easily erased. Marking people's lives for good. Now, here's what's fascinating. And this may not translate to a lot of your listening audience, across the waters. But here in the States, there's a little company here in Atlanta that has become they have a great reputation for the value that they create, for their culture, for the way they take care of their employees, for the impact that they've had. It's a little group that sells chicken sandwiches of all things in our backyard, and it's called Chick-fil-A. And I don't know if people there, know who Chick-fil-A is or...
We'll be familiar with the name.
So Chick-fil-A, last year, they produced more in gross revenue than their top five competitors combined. And they did it with one third the number of retail outlets. But here's what's fascinating. The purpose of Chick-fil-A, as expressed in their mission statement, may surprise you. They exist to become the world's most caring company.
Wow. Interesting. That's a lofty goal for anyone.
And what does that have to do with chicken sales? So their whole idea is we want to take care of people in every way that we possibly can. And it shows. And they have arguably created one of the most vibrant cultures that anyone would ever want to be a part of, with a fantastic product. And they have raving fans that are very loyal and faithful to the brand, to the point that they now have surpassed their top five competitors combined in sales. And I think that speaks to, it's not just Chick-fil-A, it's other organizations that we work together with as well, but it speaks to this idea that you take care of your people and your people will take care of your customers and your customers will tell their friends and business will be good when you commit to do good business, because people like to do good business with businesses that do good.
And all of this, I mean, I feel like I have very similar conversations with people, Randy, because all of that sounds both wonderful and commonsensical to me. It's what we would love to see in every walk of life, in every business, people doing goods for greater good, making money to invest in their company to continue to grow so that people have jobs and they love the jobs they do and all this lovely virtual cycle stuff. And it is commonsensical, but yet we still don't see it everywhere. We still don't see people following these. You've used the word movements. Let's use that. And there's still the fixation with the short-term profit-centered drive. And in all the work that you do, why have we still got this gap between the two, Randy? And what causes a company to, I'm going to say, wake up and smell the coffee and go, hey, there's a better way of doing things, right? What have you seen that happens?
Well, you're absolutely right. It seems commonsensical, but it's not common practice.
Mm.
And it all comes back to axiology, because axiology is about value judgments. It's a philosophical strain that talks about values, value creation, and value constructs, which leads to your value judgments. And everything in life is a competition of values.
Mm.
So it comes to personal values. Personal values have to be aligned with corporate values, but then the question is, what are the corporate values?
Right. And are they real?
You say, are they real? But you know, what value is more important? Is it making as much money as we can this quarter to give back to our shareholders, or is it taking care of our people this quarter in a way that they feel is substantive so that therefore long-term they have commitment to the organization to produce long-term results? And oftentimes this short-term, long-term interplay, you know, it's what's best for this quarter versus what's best for the enterprise long haul, then that's a value construct issue. And so values compete. You know, is organizations sometimes say, you know, safety first is a value. But when push comes to shove, meeting deadlines supersedes safety.
Yeah.
So you have to be consistent. And I like to say all the time, the primary role of leaders within organizations is just twofold. One, to be a champion for and a keeper of the culture, because it's an expression of who you are. And number two, to connect personal passion to corporate objectives, which has to do with an alignment of values. And so there are different principles that I have synthesized from the realm of axiology that we like to help organizations understand not only the principle, but be able to embrace the practices that then can help them use this information to transform and codify a compelling culture. And so, you know, there are principles that we teach that we've expounded upon in our books, the first being remarkable, the second being relationomics, that unpack all of these ideas.
And you warned me in my research not to try and track down all of these principles, because you've done the work of synthesizing. What a great piece of advice that was, by the way, because there was, I mean, there's a lot of information and there's a lot to decipher in these things, but we aren't going to have time to go through all the seven principles behind axiology today. I've picked maybe three that we'll get a chance to have a good conversation about, but just so people understand the full construct, Randy, those seven principles, can you just lay them out from a sort of headline perspective?
Sure. Well, the first is you have what we call them maxims. They could be called universal truths or axioms, if you like. We tried to make, for simplicity's sake, put those into the seven that we consider to be the most important. And there's some overlap, but it's a very heady academic field. For those who really want to dive in deep, they can get a copy of Robert Hartman's The Structure of Value. And good luck wading through that. But here are a few of those maxims. And we like to call them maxims because we say if you apply these to life, they will maximize your productivity. The first maxim is the maxim of viability. And the maximum viability, I'll just give you a brief definition of each one. The maximum viability just says, having been created for a purpose, fulfill the purpose for which you were created. And every single one of us should have a very clear purpose statement in life that drives our behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the North Star guides sailors at night, so we need to have some sort of grounded philosophical rootage of value base that we come back to that drives all of our behavior. So that's the maximum viability. Mm-hmm. And, you know, organizations have mission statements. They have purpose statements. They talk about why they exist. But it's fascinating to me when I talk to leaders, how very few leaders have a, what I call a life legacy statement or a life purpose statement. And I think that's critically important. Another one is what we call the maximum of creativity. And it very simply says that we are all designed to create value in life. And the idea is that we feel good about doing good. Healthy individuals, acts of human kindness, there's something within our heart that it resonates, that we like to see good things transpire, that we want to be a part of something larger than ourselves, that we want to see good happen in the world. So therefore, this is the ideas that are necessary to help create movements of good. So that's the maximum of creativity. The maximum of positivity is really fascinating to me because it's a lot of what we've already discussed or we've hinted toward. And it just simply says all the good things that you want in life are a byproduct of creating good for other people. Now, this is profound because we talked about what's the purpose of business. Well, the purpose of business is not to make money. Now, granted, if you don't make money, you're not going to be in business very long. But if you're only about making money, then it won't be too terribly long till that philosophy, that foundational value will become clear to people and they will abandon your cause because they will realize that all you're about is just simply making money. And that's not a very appealing proposition for most people, right? Mm-hmm. It's like they're not interested in just helping you make more money, but they are interested in doing good and receiving something of value. Here's another way of looking at it. What's the one thing that most people in life want? What do most people strive for? What's the number one pursuit of most people?
I don't know, security or love or any of those sorts of things, right? Maybe.
Yeah, and that's true. At the heart of that is a desire for happiness.
Right.
Everybody wants to be happy. But if you ask people, you know, what would make you happy? If I could give you one thing in life, what would make you happy? The vast majority of people, by far, their number one answer is money. Give me more money. That'll make me happy. And it's just not true. Mm. It's just not true. And we could spend a lot of time talking about
yes, we could.
But it's just not true. A very wise man by the name of John Templeton, he once said this, happiness pursued eludes, but happiness given returns. In other words, I'm the happiest as a husband when my wife is happy.
Oh, you speak for a lot of men there, my friend.
we all know that by experience, right? If mom is not happy, nobody's happy. If dad's not happy, nobody really cares. Just send him on a fishing trip and you know, give him 3 days to recover. But the reality is, I'm the happiest as a parent when my kids are happy. I'm the happiest as a leader when my team members are happy. That's how happiness comes. Happiness pursued eludes, but happiness given returns. And so if you understand that, then the idea, much like the idea of success, you've heard this said before, the fastest way to success is to make everyone around you successful. If you do that, you will be successful. And the same idea is true. So business, making money is a byproduct of doing good. And that's the idea. And that turns a lot of things upside down. And it causes a lot of things to stand on their head because we have to make sure we're pursuing the right thing. And so that's the maximum of positivity. The maximum of sustainability is quite fascinating to me because it simply says to continuously create value, you have to leverage your passion and your strengths to solve problems. This is really intriguing to me because I think it hits at the very heart of productivity.
Yeah.
You and I know, Andy, that there's been a lot of talk in the workaday world about pursuing what makes you happy, what brings you pleasure, to that whole idea of do what you love to do and the money will follow. Yeah, my grandmother told me that when I was a young boy. She said, Randy, do what you love to do and the money will follow. In psychological circles, we call that a lie.
Yeah,
because there are a lot of things I love to do, but nobody's going to ever pay me to play, pay me to do them because I don't play that very well. Mm-hmm. They're like golf. I love golf. No one's ever in my entire life offered to pay me to play golf because I just don't play well, but I love it. And so the idea of learning to love what you do is important, but you can't only pursue doing those things that you love to do. So that is a bit of a misnomer. And then there's a whole lot of talk in the world. There's a lot of emphasis upon strengths and strengths finders. And again, I think that's a wonderful thing to lean into your strengths, to leverage your strengths for maximum productivity. But you can't always just do that either. And so the key is you have to combine doing what you love to do or like to do with what you do really, really well. But here's the crucial part that so many people miss. You combine those to solve problems because that's what people will pay you to do. You can't only do what you love to do. You can't only leverage your strengths. Those things have to be combined to solve a problem. And that's what values-based theory teaches, is that productivity comes when you solve problems for other people. Does that make sense?
Oh, 100%. I'm a massive fan of Ikigai. So the Japanese model of meaning, which combines, I guess, meaning at work. So finding something that you love, finding something that you're good at, finding something you can get paid for, like you want to get paid for, and finding something that the world needs. The intersection of those four circles is what they would say is Ikigai, and therefore you'd have purpose and meaning in your work. And so to me, that's really strongly aligned to what we've just talked about there.
No doubt. That's exactly what we're talking. Spot on.
Yeah.
Because you have to solve problems in order to bring value to life.
Yeah.
Then there's the maximum of responsibility,
mm-hmm.
which simply says that responsibility drives ownership, and ownership drives responsibility, meaning that people need to be empowered to own not only the process, but the results as well. That the more they feel a sense of ownership, the more they can put their fingers on the activity, the more responsible they will be for providing the results. And I think sometimes, you know, we have organizations that are more focused on command and control
mm-hmm.
than they are about allowing widespread participation in solving problems. And we all know that the people who are closest to the problems are usually the ones who can come up with the most creative ideas on how to resolve them. And we have to, again, think through how do we allow them to participate in that process. And then as we get toward the end of, you know, the maxims, we have the maxim of generosity, which to me is, again, very, very fascinating that we might want to spend some time unpacking as well.
Yeah.
That just simply speaks to the issue that life is not complete until we've turned around and we've given back to others. The seventh and the final one is value centricity,
mm-hmm.
which just simply says that when our values are aligned, that we create a circuit of energy through which good things can flow. And so those are the seven principles, the seven maxims of value creation. And there's a lot there that we can unpack, probably much more than we have time for today. but that's a good start to the conversation.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I think when you hear all about all seven and you understand all seven, this thing around value or value structure or creating value, however you want to kind of phrase it, to me, they're all around guidelines to make great choices, right? And that's my simplistic take on this whole thing you've introduced me to, which I have loved, by the way. A simple set of guidelines to make some better choices in life, and at work. And so we look, I reckon there's two or three we should have a bit of a play with. And I'd like to start, if we could, Randy, with the maximum viability, because I actually think you've got some great stuff in there to unpack. I'm a massive fan of purpose statements and value statements. I spend quite a bit of time helping individuals and companies kind of get into that sort of stuff. But I know you do it a lot, and you've even got some kind of resources that might be very, very helpful for people to sort of use to get into this. So let's dig into that. So you talked about companies having value statements. Individuals should have them. I mean, I come from the perspective of, if you're going to have these things, let's make them honest, authentic, and usable. I think if you have those things, they can act as an incredible kind of anchor point for anything that you do. Whenever troubles come your way, they're the thing that holds you in place. So where's your take on why are you so passionate about individuals having purpose statements and how those are made?
Great question. I'd love to jump into that. But first, I've got to go back and I've got to commend you, because when you sort of synthesize the whole idea of axiology, talking about it being about value judgments and how we make decisions, that is the very heart of axiology.
Great.
Because it is, and so you've grasped it. So I applaud you for that. Because it is about how we value certain aspects of our world, the decisions that we make, the judgments that we come to, and how we behave. So first of all, thank you for that. Secondly, when it comes to viability, a purpose statement, organizations exist for a reason. If you don't know the reason for which you exist, you're going to flounder. And that has to be clear. And the values that endeavor is based upon have to be clear as well. And you and I both know organizations that have gone through the exercise to create a mission statement and also articulate their values, but they have to be not only embraced and articulated, but they have to be embodied. And oftentimes they're not embodied. And if it's not embodied, then people will learn very quickly it's disingenuous rhetoric.
Yeah.
So it has to be both based upon the reality, and there can be an aspirational component to it as well, because we're always striving to be better. But if it's all aspirational and no activity to back that up, then we lose people's trust rather quickly. But why it's so critically important is exactly what you said. Our values and our legacy statement, our purpose statement, serves as the foundation upon which everything else resides. Mm-hmm. It should be the framework through which we make our decisions. It states why we exist. And here's why it's important. Because individuals, whether they articulate it or not, whether they write it down or not, they have values that their life pursuit is based upon. Mm-hmm. All of us do. Much better that that's clearly stated and clearly understood. So therefore, then you can align that with an organization that appreciates that value, those values. Because again, value centricity is created when our personal values align with the values of the organization, because we get excited. And when that happens and organizations hire to values, they no longer have to light a fire underneath people. They get to fan the flame within them and turn them loose to do what they're naturally wanting to do.
Love that.
And that's when a good match is made. But it serves, like I mentioned earlier, as a North Star. So when you are in the midst of a storm, when you are going through change, when you have dreams that are dashed, that North Star, much like sailing at night, you navigate because it's always aligned with the axis of the earth, right? You know where you're going. You may not know quite how to get there, and you may be caught in the storm and you've got to adjust the sails, but you know ultimately who you are and where you're going. And so I think that's important. And we want to provide for your listeners an opportunity to craft their own life purpose statement. And, you know, we had committed in the notes, in the show notes, we're going to put a link to to one of our web pages where there will be free opportunity, access to information for free to help guide you through the process of crafting your own life purpose statement. And it involves understanding, first of all, what are your values? And there are aesthetic values, there are ethical values, there are functional values, and there's a whole wide array of values that are listed there, and you can, you know, circle those that are most important to you. And then it also takes you through an exercise to identify your passion. What are those things that you do really well? And it'll help you do what we talked about earlier, to take your strengths and take your passion and then align that to what problem do you solve, and help you craft a very succinct, easily memorable, I should say. But it'll help them create a very succinct, compelling life purpose statement. And that's just a resource we like to provide for your listeners.
Hey, that's great. And they will definitely appear in the show notes. So you can check those out. Get stuck into that. I think having any kind of framework or guide to help somebody craft that is so valuable, because it can feel like a pretty daunting thing to do. Trying to, well, what are my values and what are my purpose? Sounds like the simplest question someone could ask you, because it's about you, right? Easy. Who knows me? Me. I know me. I think actually taking lots of people through this process, it's a tough thing to do. It takes an awful lot of thought to get there.
It does, but I also want to encourage your readers to realize this is your first iteration.
Yeah.
It will be refined over the course of time, and you'll finally settle on language that is very compelling for you. And that's what I like to say. It needs to be clear, it needs to be concise, and it needs to be compelling. Whether those words mean anything to anybody else, it doesn't matter. If it's important to you and it helps ground you and it helps guide you in your pursuits, that's the purpose of a life purpose statement. So give yourself some grace. It may not be flowery and memorable at first, but over the course of time, as you refine it, you'll grow into something you feel very comfortable about.
That's such good advice. That is such good advice, because people can get hung up on it sounding like the tagline for an advert and having to be sweet and beautiful. It's really not about that. I'd much rather people have something that speaks to them and really helps them than be smart, pretty, tidy, whatever it might be. That's really great advice.
And to help people, let me just share my personal purpose statement. It might give you some people a guide, but here's mine. My purpose is to, in word and in deed, inspire people to become remarkable. Now, nobody else, that may not mean a thing to anybody else. It doesn't matter. I've already talked about what the word remarkable means to me. It's the name of our book, our first book. It's the name of our company. It means to leave a positive, indelible impression on other people's lives. I'm not a motivational speaker. I like to inspire people. I think there's a big difference between motivation and inspiration. I want to inspire people, and I want to do it in my words, because I, sort of fancy myself as a communication expert. So both in the written word and the spoken word, that's important to me. But not just in words, because verbiage alone isn't impactful. People want to see it in your actions. So by word and by deed, I want to inspire people to be remarkable. And I wake up every day excited about having the opportunity to do that for individuals, for organizations. And it keeps me focused on the right things.
Well, my experience of working with you so far, Randy, you're living your purpose, mate, and it's coming through, because you inspired me a enthusiasm for this topic to go away and research and find out some more stuff. And it confirmed things I loved and knew, and it brought me a whole bunch of other things to go and look at. So as one person, I can absolutely verify, well, you are delivering your purpose, my friend, and I'm very grateful for it.
I appreciate the affirmation.
You're very, very welcome. I do want to at least dig into another one of the maxims, because, again, I think you've got a fascinating story behind it. And I think generosity, right, is a really important one, because there is an awful lot of self-thought and selfish thought that can be focused around business and what it does. I think it's the antithesis of what we're talking about here. So unpack the generosity maxim for me. Tell me about that, and tell me why it speaks to you so strongly.
Well, it does speak to me strongly, Andy, because I think it's sort of the culmination of what it means to create a movement of good. And we do live in a pretty self-absorbed, myopic world where it's all about me. And the question is, what's in it for me? What will I get out of this? And we talk about the me generation, which, quite frankly, I think is unfair. I don't think that's just the millennials. I think that's everybody. We all tend to be a part of the me generation. But we need to help people grow out of being a consumer into being a value creator. And that's what the maxim of generosity is all about. And it is fun. It is intriguing, because it's about giving back. It's about making good in the world. And interesting story that goes behind this is that many people may be familiar with Abraham Maslow and his hierarchy of needs, right? It was a 5-tier hierarchy that talked about human motivational behavior. And it was very interesting and very fascinating. And for those who remember it from your psychology 101 class, basically Abraham Maslow said that human behavior is driven by a need to fulfill certain aspects of life, the first of which being physiological needs, food, shelter, and clothing. If you don't have food, shelter, and clothing, then everything else, you know, in life will be driven by that until that is acquired. Then it goes to security needs, both emotionally and physically, and then love and belonging, and then self-esteem. And many will remember, because it was the pinnacle, you know, what we were all supposed to have memorized for the test, self-actualization was at the top of the pyramid. And that was this idea that you've attained your full potential. Well, interestingly enough, Abraham Maslow and Robert Hartman were good friends. They both taught at the University of Mexico at the Cuernavaca campus. And their wives were good friends. And one night they were having dinner together. And after dinner, they went out to the patio and sipping on some brandy. Robert Hartman turned to Abe Maslow and he goes, "Hey, Abe, so tell me about this hierarchy of needs you've been working on." And he unpacked it and he explained it. Hartman sat there intently listening. And then finally, at the very end, he goes, "So let me get this straight. So self-actualization means that you fulfilled your potential. You become all that you were meant to be. And that's the best that life has to offer." And he goes, "Absolutely. You've got it. You've got it, Robert." And then Robert Hartman turned to him and goes, "So what? So what if you fulfill your potential? What good have you done? What have you given back? What legacy have you created? What good have you given back to those around you? What dent have you made in the universe? So you've had a self-absorbed existence. You've fulfilled your potential. So what?" And it messed Abraham Maslow up.
I can only imagine.
And it sent him into a rabbit hole. And he emerged several months later. And if you do your research, if you, you know, just Google it, you'll find that it wasn't widely printed. You got to look for it. But he added three tiers to his five-tier hierarchy. He added aesthetic needs, and he added cognitive needs. But most important, above self-actualization, the top tier now, the pinnacle of the pyramid, is self-transcendence, which means that it had a metaphysical connotation, but it meant giving back. It meant connecting with humanity in such a way that you leave a positive wake in the world, that life's not just about consuming and accumulating for yourself. It's about what have you done good for others? And I think that's powerful, because for me, and I think for anybody in a worthwhile endeavor, the quality of your life will be marked not in the possessions that you amass, but in the people that you impact in a positive way. And I think that's what the maxim of generosity is all about. It's about, you know, making life good. I actually have a book coming out, Andy, in August, and the full title of it, the abbreviated title is Make Life Good, but the full title is You've Made a Good Living. Now, make life good. And it plays off of this whole idea of what is doing good in the world, and how do we do that? And how do we get involved in other people's lives to truly provide for them resources and opportunities they could not provide for themselves, and send their life on a totally different trajectory? If everyone in the world did for one person what they wish they could do for everyone, they could change the whole world for that someone. And I guarantee you, in changing the world for someone else, it will radically change your world as well. And so I think sometimes, you know, we think about changing the world as this unrealistic, formidable challenge that we can't change the world for good, but you can change the world for someone. And in changing the world for someone, it will change the world for good.
Wow. This is the thing that I have loved about this topic, because you've done a lot of the work of synthesizing stuff, making it easy, relatable, transferable into simple language. Come back to that common sense thing. The words that you've used compared to the tomes of information there are from Hartman and all the rest of it. Nice, simple, applicable language that people will be familiar with, but actually grabbing it and doing something with it is what really makes the difference, right? It's what really helps us move forward. And I can't believe I'm saying this already, but we're at the part of the show, Randy, where I'm looking for you to be an even greater summarizer, right? An even greater synthesis of wisdom, if you could, in that when we think about that last message of really going out there and creating good, and creating good in what you do in life and in business. If you were to give people just three pieces of advice, my friend, that they could fit on three little sticky notes, what lessons from axiology and all the other things that you've talked about here today would you leave behind?
The first I would say is this: do good and life will be good. That summarizes axiology. But then, secondly, these truths are transcendent, so apply them personally as much as you apply them professionally, because they will radically change and alter the way you see and do life. And then thirdly, from an organizational level, remember that people like to do good business with businesses that do good. So the question is, what good are we doing in the world? And those three simple ideas will impact organizational life. It will become magnetic for those who want to be a part of pursuing the mission that you're on with the value construct that you possess. And value centricity is a word we made up, but it's when values are aligned, then we can contribute our resources to light up the world. And that's what we want to do.
Well, you've lit my world up since I've met you, Randy. I really appreciate you. I really appreciate the message that you've kind of shared with us today. Before I let you go, if people want to find out a bit more places to research, come and find your website and stuff, where should they look, my friend? Where can they find you?
Always happy to connect with people on LinkedIn. It's just Dr. Randy Ross. You can find me, Dr. Randy Ross on LinkedIn. And that's our website as well, drrandyross.com. Dr. no period, just drrandyross.com. And you can find out a little bit more about, you know, the services that we provide, the resources that we have, the books and digital programs that we offer. But most importantly, I just want to encourage you listeners to take advantage of the free offering that we have to craft their own life purpose statement.
Absolutely. I'm going to put all of that stuff in the show notes, all the links to the books, the website, the lot. And there's so much to unpack. We barely scratched the surface in the time we've had together today, but I have absolutely loved it, Randy. Thank you so much for coming on, my friend.
My pleasure. And I wish you well in your every endeavor, Andy.
Thank you, my friend. You take care. Okay, everyone. That was Dr. Randy Ross. And if you'd like to find out more about him or any of the amazing topics we've talked about today, please go ahead and check out the show notes. So, that concludes today's episode. I hope you've enjoyed it, found it interesting, and heard something maybe that will help you become a stickier, more successful business from the inside going forward. If you have, please like, comment, and subscribe. It really helps. I'm Andy Gorham, and you've been listening to the Sticky from the Inside podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.